Online, Channel 9 Live, everybody out in the virtual world, tweet your questions to at CH9 Live. We have an incredible duo up here. The great Bill Buxton, designer. You've been seeing a lot of him on Channel 9 and at Mix. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And then, of course, Eric Meyer, the master of side effects, as some know him as. So thanks for coming on. We wanted to do this today to talk about design, but design from sort of the larger picture, because designing user experience, designing libraries and programming languages, in some sense, they're both abstractions for interacting with computing. So let's talk.
Shall we do it in English or Dutch?
Yes. So what we discovered before we talked here, that we even have common roots, because Bill used to work in the Netherlands, so he speaks Dutch.
Really?
And beetje.
Wow.
Or?
Well, we should do it in English first. But we can maybe translate into Dutch for everyone out there.
You can Twitter in Dutch, and we'll answer.
Awesome. From Holland, tweet in Dutch.
Tweet in Dutch. And it's not a coincidence. We both spent formative parts of our career in a city in the Netherlands called Utrecht. He was born there. I was a visitor. Where there was an incredibly rich atmosphere and infrastructure for computing, but also the arts. Mm. And so I went there to do electronic and computer music, and taught at the university and worked in the studio. And the computer science department was very good. And there was a lot of interaction. So the people who were, many of the people teaching there were also involved in music and art. And so there's a very creative mindset, which I think would be fair to say unusual for a computer science department.
Interesting.
And I think Holland has more designers per square kilometer than almost any country in the world. They have a number of really good design schools. And what's interesting, some of them are at technical universities, not at fine arts or social science universities. So the Technical University of Delft is one of the longest and largest design schools in the world. At the Technical University of Twente in northern Netherlands, there's another one, and there's a very good one that I have a strong relationship with in Eindhoven,
nice,
which is right by Philips.
Yes, and in the south.
But even in Eindhoven, there's still another design school besides the TU. So I think this is actually relevant, because it says, just like one of the reasons there's so many great hockey players come out of Canada, because we have a whole minor hockey system. It's part of the culture. There's an infrastructure. In the Netherlands, you have a strong infrastructure that juxtaposes design and technology. And so to have the common thread between his primary discipline and mine is, we can take another Dutch reference, and let's say Rem Koolhaas.
Yep.
So he's an architect. And if you think about it, how I relate what we do together would be like the relationship between the architect, somebody like Rem Koolhaas, with a structural engineer. And if Rem designs something, it's going to fall down unless he's got somebody who tells him that won't stand up. You can't do that. But understands the design intent and can build it up and then come this way. But at the same time, the structural engineer may say, there's this incredible new construction technique, this incredible new technology and material that we can do other things with. Let me explain it to you so you can come up, what can you do with this, right? And it can work both ways. It's not. Mm-hmm. And then there's the third pillar, of course, that's not sitting here, is the person who is as creative in the business model to figure out how to make this financially viable as a business.
Interesting.
But I think the problem traditionally in software industries, what we called the architect was actually the structural engineer, and there was no architect.
Hmm.
And the main transition in the industry is that we're now recognizing that structural engineers are different than the construction engineers. They don't manage the construction site or do the building. And there's these different roles of architect, the software architect, or the systems architect is different than the design architect, if we will. They're all doing design within their discipline.
Yes.
And at Microsoft, we have now this very strong sense of this, that absolutely the Series 7 phone has this structure. Somebody, a three pillars, design, business, and technology, business, or BXT, we call it, working as peers to bring the product with a holistic perspective. So we've got two parts of the triad represented. I don't know. Do you feel it that?
Yeah. To talk a little bit more about Dutch design, one of the things that I'm very much attracted to is the Stijl movement, which is a very minimalistic piece
the
of art.
The Stijl movement.
Stijl.
S-T-I-G-T-L. In the 60s and 70s, there was a whole fashion thing about these red rectangles and blue stripes and so on. That's visually, if that might conjure up something. But Rietveld would be
And Mondrian.
And Mondrian. And in fact, on the Malibaan in Utrecht is the Rietveld house, right?
Yes.
And there was a style in architecture, graphic design, and so on that was really stunning, that had this fascinating balance between materials, technology, and a really new language.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so one of the things there that kind of that struck me as a small child actually is this idea of full abstraction. And the idea of full abstraction is to really get to the essence of what is beauty. So what the Stijl, what they try to do is you could only use the basic colors and basic shapes, you know, squares and no diagonal lines, no circles or something, and then with only those basic materials, you try to get the essence of what is beauty. And also things like perspective, you know, are forbidden. Mm. You cannot make something that looks like it's 3D. Yeah. And actually, the movement fell apart when some people tried to do diagonal lines. Yeah. And so they started to fight. And that's something that in my work, I really try to adhere to, is this finding this kind of minimalistic, the essence of something.
And there's a... There's a great line from actually an aviator, but whose name escapes me at the moment, a French aviator. But the statement was this: and by the way, if you talk to Albert Schum, who was the studio head that bringing the Series 7 phone out, he would adhere to this too. And the line goes like this: the design isn't finished when there's nothing more to add; it's finished when there's nothing more to take out.
Interesting.
And a lot of software development in the past has been the new version, the N+1 version. We have to add new features. Let's add stuff. It was always about addition. And then you clutter up what used to perhaps be an elegant, really clean design into something that becomes just like Baroque in a time when neoclassicism was more appropriate.
Yeah.
And so my sense is that we should improve our products by taking stuff out and making them better at the same time.
But that's an excellent, excellent point. And it might be a point where there may be some divergence in your two paths in the following sense. Designing a programming language, you could say we're done when we don't have anything more to take out. Mm-hmm. But as we're learning in JavaScript, and as Eric has learned for many, many years in his career, sometimes you have to keep adding new things because the way in which the general purpose tool is used changes. And so taking things out after it's been out for 5 or 10 years is almost impossible.
Yeah. So one thing that, I mean, Anders Helsberg, you know, the main designer of C#, says that really nicely. He said at some point a language ages because, you know, it kind of keeps on growing and growing and getting more features that you can never remove. And at some point it means that, you know, you have to stop and move to the next language. One person that was really good at it was Nicholas Wirth.
Yes.
He always would take a language and then the next language, by definition, he would take things out. He could only add a feature if he would take certain other features out. And you can see in his work, he has a whole line of languages from Pascal to Modula, and every time he starts kind of from scratch and doing the next language.
Excellent.
By the way, Nick Wirth is like a Swiss computer scientist. One of the gods.
Okay.
You can thank him for basically Logitech being in business making mice. Hmm. He built one of the first, this thing called the Lilith machine, which was this beautiful bitmapped, one of the first bitmap displays ever.
Nice.
He's younger than both of us, energy-wise. I think. He's closer to the age of my father, but he's younger than me.
Wow.
Because he's got the same, just in terms of the sparkle in his eyes. I've had graduate students who are older than him.
Excellent.
I think what comes down to saying is that there's in computer science you'll use the term refactoring, but the you have to look at these things, because often when you're adding things or you're making these changes, it's because the language hasn't been used and what you anticipated it for. And that a lot of these other things you can consolidate into something simpler. It's a question of you because you had the wrong abstraction.
Yes. Mm.
And it's how do you take these details and take multiple things that you thought were orthogonal or independent, and you, through abstraction, you bring them into a single gestalt or into a single whole, and you find a unified thing. And I think this is absolutely true in design, exactly as it is in engineering, but it's also true in psychology. This notion of aggregation is the fundamental of skill acquisition. The bending of your knees, weight in your lower ski, up skill forward, lean forward, and stuff like that, all of those individual problems come into a single gestalt and are unified when you come. And when you actually are skiing, it just becomes one thing.
Sure.
And languages have to accommodate that. And if you can't retrofit them by refactoring, you have to then start a new language.
Yeah. So a great example of what you just described is when I'm working on this thing called the reactive framework,
yeah.
Where also for a long time, this is about coordinating and orchestrating asynchronous computations. And for the longest time, it looked like just like a gray mass, and I couldn't see the abstractions. And then one day I was explaining this to Gavin Bierman from Microsoft Research,
yeah.
And then suddenly I saw the abstraction, and it was like the fog cleared, and then it was clearly there,
yeah.
and everything kind of came together, and there was one unified, the essence kind of came out. So that was... Yeah.
It's a beautiful moment. So now,
a beautiful moment.
I hate to interject, but yeah. Channel 9 Live, we must interact with the world.
Good.
ZBrad has a fun one. Should minimalism also apply to framework libraries?
Definitely. I think definitely, because I'm very a big fan of composability. So the framework should provide you with the basic building blocks and the glue to compose things together. Because we cannot anticipate, as a framework designer, you cannot anticipate what things the user wants to do with it. So you cannot think for the user, so you can think kind of what direction, and then you make it easy for the user to do whatever they want to do with your framework. So yes, I'm very, very big fan of minimalism in library design.
Hey, by the way, there's something funny happening here that I suspect you may not have expected.
Talk to me.
So we've never met before.
Yeah, by design.
And so notice that he's the systems guy and is extremely literate and articulate about design.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure anybody's ever heard me speak about technical things and before in the computer science sense. And
sure.
It's a really important reflection about where Microsoft is these days, mm-hmm. is that without any rehearsal or knowing or anything like that mm-hmm. there is this Esperanto kind of
yes.
going on in terms yep. of, because if we're going to work together, we have to understand each other's tradition, each other's stories, mm-hmm. The heroes, who they did, because otherwise we don't have a common language.
Yep.
And very often designers are whining, nobody understands me, but what I always say to them is, do you understand about as much about the engineers as you expect them to understand about you? And if you don't, shut up
exactly.
and get down to work.
Yep.
And vice versa. And it's like, and that's the deal. And then you get this, then you can have this kind of energy go on to the product instead of fighting for turf.
Right. Excellent. So let's take another question. Jose Farado, what do you think about UI UX design based patents? And if great UI UX software design is being threatened by such patents? UI patents, UX patents.
Okay, so that's a very charged question. So I'll try and give you a fair and considered answer. First, as a university professor, I refuse to allow my students to patent stuff. I believe stuff at university, it spoils and destroys the academic, the community of scholars, which is the foundation of academic research. In my personal opinion, if you're my graduate student, you want to patent stuff, you're no longer my graduate student. And that's always been my principle. I've never patented, none of my students have ever patented anything at universities.
Okay.
When I'm employed by a company, whether we like it or not, this is the world we live in, and patenting is part of my job. That's what I'm paid for. And I don't think it's wrong. I believe, however, that there is significant abuse in the patent system that needs to be fixed, that does hold back innovation. My view is that there's a degree of common sense that has to be exercised. anybody in Microsoft Research, if they can't come up with a patent every day and perhaps five a day, they probably don't deserve their job. If they patent,
wow.
If they patent five things a day, they also don't deserve their job because they don't know which yep. ones are worth doing, right? And it's a waste of time. There are key core things that I think are worth protecting. And the other part is patents don't just exist so you can license them and prevent other people. They're there to give you a balanced portfolio so you there is no litigation because everybody's infringing on each other. Mm. Like in photocopiers, for example, let's move away from Microsoft and our industry. In the photocopiers, the companies all had enough of a portfolio that they wouldn't sue them because they knew you infringe this, we infringe on that. So you basically do cross-licensing agreements, and so you actually open up, you make it more competitive, and you make it open up for innovation. Mm. And I think that these are delicate issues. I don't take them frivolously, but I think there's, I hope that both the legal system and the patent offices and the practitioners exercise common sense so that we don't hold back innovation.
Excellent. So let's go back to the questions because we're getting a lot of them in now. Al3891, can't people both be architects and structural engineers? So can't you have an Eric and you as one? Now that would be really hard, but that's the question.
Go ahead.
I definitely believe that's the case, and I think you know you need to have both skills because if you're only one, then often so suppose I'm just an architect, but I know nothing about structural engineering. It doesn't mean that I have to be a superb structural engineer, but you need to know your limitations and need to know what the limitations are. I can't come up with the most beautiful programming language, but if I know that it's impossible to implement that efficiently or write even a compiler for that, then my idea is useless. So there is this balance. So you have to know kind of a little bit of both.
Yep. So I have a non-conflicting response, but it's different.
Great.
And it comes from a friend. So the first thing is I want to make a distinction between awareness, literacy, and expertise. Mm-hmm. And so the problems we deal with are really hard. Mm-hmm. I want to work with the best engineers in the world. I want to work with the best business people in the world, best marketing people in the world, and the best designers in the world. To become the best in the world is a full-time job. And so not only comes my metaphor, it comes from Bill Muggeridge, who's one of the founders of IDEO. He describes the perfect people as T-shaped people, capital T.
Yeah.
Where the height of the font is your depth, and in your core, you have terrific depth. But up here, you have bridge over to the sides to adjacent disciplines with more than awareness, but to literacy. And so when you have one T-shaped person, which is their depth is in the base and centered on the engineering side, another one centered on the design side, another one centered in the business side, when you bring them together, all of the bars cross over, so you have a common language, a common base, a common ground from which to work, but you have unbelievable depth. Renaissance men and women have not been yep. possible since the Renaissance, and even then, it didn't really exist. Donatello could not have existed without the Medici, and the Medici couldn't have been the Medici if they were trying to be artists. Right? Even then you had specialists. And the thing is that it's like long live the king, the king is dead, long live the king. The Renaissance is over. Long live the Renaissance, but it's a Renaissance team, not the Renaissance person.
So I think you explain it much more eloquently than what I did. But yeah. That's exactly what I meant. Yeah. You need to have that overlap. But, yep. you're
excellent. And feel free to applause if you want
whatever.
To, people. So let's go down to... can you talk more about the role of our fundamental cultural metaphors on design language, a la metaphors to live by?
Whoa.
Wait a minute. Where's the...
No, I love doing this stuff because you think you've had every question you could possibly thrown at you. And you're getting
that's
one
a good
like this,
one, then.
Like, it's a
yeah.
good one. So the critical thing is to say... there's real problems about universal design. There was a question that came up to me earlier about just cultural relevance of skills, that there's not only individual differences, but just in the early graphical user interfaces, they had light switches, toggle light switches to turn things on and off. Mm-hmm. And up was on and down was off, of course. Except he knows, not of course. For example, in Germany, down is up, is on, and up is off. And even at that level of a trivial metaphor of a switch, there's deep cultural differences that if we don't understand the communities where we're putting our products, we're getting them wrong. And if we get something as simple as a switch wrong, think about all of the other, if we're thinking about this cognitive level, at the social level, as well as the motor sensory level, the chances for these types of conflicts to happen are immense, which is why if you don't do your social science right and tailor products specifically for the target audience, you're going to get them wrong.
And one thing that I often notice is that there's still, like you say, with the light switches, but often with UIs, there's a right to left or left to right bias, which
Excellent.
Is and so how, but like in some sense, you know, the population is divided in left-handed and right-handed. Yeah. So how can we, you know, get around those things that are like really like physical distinctions between people?
So, for example, when the trackpad in a laptop is in the middle, then you can put your mouse on either side, and you've got a bias. But of course, the problem with that is that they don't care for your left or right hand because they don't let you use the trackpad and the mouse at the same time, which is absurd. But it's another story. why can't I turn pages this way, navigate this way while I'm pointing here?
We got that. Question.
Hey, well, we should.
All right, let's keep the people out there in. So we have Blob-O-Matic. Is it possible to have good interfaces that flow on devices as small as smartphones? I think we're going to get our answer.
Ah.
So, how big is Microsoft Surface?
It's probably about this big.
Right? It's as high as this table? Pretty big?
Yes, pretty big.
Not a mobile device, right?
Well, you can actually put wheels on it.
Wheels on it. And it's what's it got underneath, inside of it?
Camera.
And? Projector.
Yep.
And then you project on a surface and you see the shadows and the camera sees the shadows, tells the computer, everything's like that.
Huh?
Mobile device. It's my camera. Okay? Hey, you see? Look out.
Great shot.
We've got a little bit of light here, but if... Okay,
it's upside down,
but here we are, okay? So the first thing is, my camera has a projector in it. The interesting thing about projectors is they can be really tiny now. And furthermore, they're an interesting device because the display is larger than the device itself.
Yep.
It's an interesting attribute.
Interesting.
So what this means is, can I have a piece of paper?
Absolutely.
Okay, so just any old piece. So this is Surface, and you can touch on the top. But if I have my mobile phone with a projector and that, I can just take it and bingo.
Turn it upside.
I can do it there, and all of a sudden my mobile phone, which is traditionally the most intimate and private of devices and personal, becomes the most ubiquitous technology for social computing face to face. So I can pull out in a restaurant on the table something, and the camera can see my fingers just like it would, because it's like a surface, and I can do this, you can do that, and so it doesn't care whose finger it is. So in a sense, right there in a product that's been shipping since about November this year, and commercially, a Nikon camera, we have an illustration of how you can rethink, if you look at the world around you, you can rethink. And now, I can come with that idea that to somebody who really knows how to program. Now we got unbelievably nice to get the computation models to do the vision and get that stuff working reliably. That's a hard problem. I can't do that.
Yeah.
I know what P and V are, and semaphores and shared memory in terms of, but that's as far as I go.
Yeah.
Right? But this is where, there's great new stuff happening that was not possible to do even a year ago.
Yes.
Excellent. So that question was well answered. Let's see here. What are your views on minimalism in language syntax, e.g. curly braces, constructs, etc., functions?
So I do have pretty strong feelings about that. I think when you look at your code, it must look beautiful, because you fundamentally write code for other people to read, because it's a language for humans to communicate, to express your ideas in code. So now, one thing is that mathematics is another language that humans invented, an artificial language, to communicate with each other and to express ideas. So there's hundreds or maybe thousands of years of tradition in mathematics where there's language design. And mathematicians often use white space very, very cleverly to kind of, you know, lay out their formulas to make them read better. Somehow we have forgotten that in the programming language world, where we're using curly braces and semicolons. Haskell and Python are two languages where white space is significant. And in Haskell in particular, we make the programs in Haskell look very much like mathematics. And that's just tapping into this tradition of people that, you know, of an evolution of hundreds of years where people have fine-tuned that language. So why do you throw that away? Let's use that knowledge and use that to make a better programming language.
Excellent. So I want to get some more questions, because unfortunately we're running out of time. This is an interesting one.
How are we running out of
time? We're running out of time.
But before we go there, I saw that Bill has, like, you know, another box there that, you know, I'm sorry for the viewers there, but I would like to see, I'm curious what's in there, what's the story behind this thing.
Okay, we'll do this quickly. This is just...
This is great. We'll finish with this.
Yes. This is the horn. While I'm opening this, I'll just say that to the tweet about keyboard and mice aren't considered NUI, but you consider them, you're right.
Candy Dolfer, Dutch saxophone player, plays this thing too.
This is a MIDI. This is actually a digital instrument. You could type, you could type with this. I could tweet with this if I actually mapped it, but I don't know how. But that would be a silly thing to do. So it's unnatural for that, but it's natural to play music if you're trained as a saxophone player. So this is what I used in a keynote. It came out in about 1987 or so, 1986, 87. It's just a beautiful instrument. And it's sensitive to the breath, and just your embouchure. You have 12 muscles in your mouth. You can actually get a tremolo from a vibrato from here.
Yeah. From the reed. You run it through a computer?
You run it through a computer, yeah.
Excellent. And then it can sound like a trumpet.
Or a saxophone, or a flute, or a clarinet.
Guitar. Nice. Yeah. Very cool. So we do have a little bit more time.
Okay.
Programming languages shape our logic. UX design shapes our actions. Do you foresee convergence? So, in some sense, do you understand the question?
Well, I'd say that what your answer to the previous question about white space was sort of saying the shape of, it's almost like the Dadaists, Kurt Schwitters and the Hugo Ball and so on, is saying that it helps understand the shape of the program by the white space. So in some sense, we've already seen that happening, and the use of typography. But also the questions of language. What I learned about formal languages, BNF, absolutely shape how I analyze user interfaces and complexity. And you can analyze a BNF grammar of the action language and make predictions of complexity, probability, variance, and length of time. And that's there's technical science to design. It's not all artsy fartsy.
Yeah, and on my side, I would say I think there's a lot that we as language designers can learn from the kind of, you know, the real designers, the kind of, you know, the real designers, the graphical designers, and the artists. And so definitely.
But developers are also craftsmen, and they're also artists.
Developers,
they're highly creative.
Yes,
absolutely.
And writing code is an art form. Hey, thank you very much for coming. You guys, what a wonderful duo. Well, thank you for doing this.
Our pleasure.
I love the story of Holland. and thank you guys. I guess I got the sign that we're ending. And so coming up next is going to be incredibly interesting once I figure out what it is.